McGraw-Hill Ascent Audio presents Better Humans, Better Performance, Driving Leadership, Teamwork, and Culture with Intentionality by Peter Ray, Jamie Stoller, and Alan Culp. Narrated by Emmanuel Chumacero. Publisher's note, in this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Preface: How do we get great performance? Does the person of high competence and low character get a pass? Does the person of high character with threshold competence get a chance? How an organization's leaders answer those questions reveals how they think great performance can be achieved. The evidence that we will present in this book is that great performance happens by getting better at who we are, by practicing virtue to get better at what we do. The concept is captured in the book title, Better Humans, Better Performance, and How Do We Get Better at Who We Are? The time-honored solution to this question is that we get better at who we are when we practice the seven classical virtues: trust, compassion, courage, justice, wisdom, temperance, and hope. Throughout the book, whenever we use the word virtue or virtues, we mean these seven classical virtues. For the ancient Greeks, the word arete, translated as virtue, arete means excellence of any kind, such as the fitness of an athlete, the skill of a soldier, the healing abilities of a physician, the teaching and research of a scholar, and the design insights of an engineer, as well as the ability of anyone to be wise, brave, and caring. Virtue is the act of living up to our potential, thus enabling us to flourish. When flourishing and living up to our potential are the goals, virtue is the name of the game. The hard part is practicing virtue when it is most needed, during periods of instability. In 1987, the term VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, was coined by the U.S. Army War College. Interestingly, the phrase was created during a time of relative stability between the fall of the Berlin Wall and before the terrorist attacks on September 11th. For that reason, VUCA may misrepresent our time as more volatile than periods such as World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, or the Cuban Missile Crisis. That said, at the time this book was written, there was no shortage of VUCA situations, such as the world being besieged by the COVID-19 pandemic, social injustice issues, climate change, and the Russian assault on Ukraine. In whatever time we live, we would like to drive disruption down to zero, even though the world doesn't offer that option. So, our best response to disruption is learning to normalize discomfort. When we do so, we better adapt to disruption, pressure, stress, and adversity. We contend that virtue helps vaccinate us to normalize discomfort so that we can perform well even during periods of disruption. Virtue has guided high performance in humans during adverse conditions for 3,000 years at least. Yet somehow virtue must be rediscovered in every age. The wisdom of the ages makes clear that priority matters. Character defined by the seven classical virtues comes first. Performance follows. Performance is a collateral benefit of practicing virtue intentionally and wisely. We readily acknowledge that practicing virtue in an uncertain world where some want to win at all costs and where narcissism sometimes runs amok is anything but easy. Making lives better for others might feel sentimental when we are competing for our slice of the pie. Yet, the practice of virtue can be more serviceable to our self-interest than our skeptical minds might realize. At least in the long term, the pursuit of virtue is both strategically smart and a better way to live. Whom does the book hope to support? Humans. Humans who want to become better people and better performers, like for-profit and non-profit leaders, physicians, engineers, athletes, coaches, teachers, and soldiers. In short, everyone, including families, humans already strive to perform at a high level and recognize the importance of character. Yet too few understand that virtue is a performance amplifier. Too many lack insight into how the language and practice of virtue tighten the band of reliable performance, especially when things go sideways with VUCA events. Our aspiration is to make this research accessible to any person interested in becoming better at who they are so that they can become better at what they do in school, work, and life. The concepts in this book are relevant to the young and old alike, regardless of status, income, or education. The powerful impact of character on performance is generalizable across geography, race, and context, in business, academia, and healthcare, and in families, teams, and organizations. Integrating human performance research with the practice of virtue is what we hope to democratize. How can this book be read? The virtues undergird and lead to high performance, as depicted in Figure P.1. Figure P.1. The virtues undergird and lead to high performance. Arete, excellence, better performance. Habits, coaching, restoration. Culture, character and competence. Teamwork, resiliency, engagement, raising and teaching. Innovation, diversity, equity and inclusion. Character, better humans. Trust, compassion, courage, justice, wisdom, temperance, hope. Together, the virtues make up character, which you can see is the floor to support all the pillars that are needed for performance. These pillars include culture, teamwork, coaching, habits, resiliency, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and family. Each of these pillars will be developed in separate chapters, which can be listened to in any order. These various pillars are the key to the better performance part of the book title, because the virtues are underneath it all. People often don't know how character is formed, nor how to enhance character development. While virtue is good in and of itself, virtue also offers four important performance benefits. 1. Virtue provides a common language for leaders, teams, and organizations to understand what it means to excel. 2. Virtue is a performance amplifier for competence. 3. Virtue is malleable, and it is available to everyone. 4. Virtue leads to more reliable performance under pressure. This book is organized so that each of the chapters regarding applications to better performance, chapters 3 onward, has a similar cadence. Each begins with stories or case studies exemplifying how the virtues inform leadership, teams, and cultures. Following the stories are discussions of the supportive evidence coming from multiple sectors, including those in which the authors work: technology, manufacturing, healthcare, and academia. Lastly, tools are woven into the chapter or included at the end, along with key takeaways. Is this a book about success and human performance? Yes, but success is a byproduct of getting better at who we are through the practice of virtue. For many of us, our ultimate concern is external achievement. There is nothing wrong with getting ahead. Still, be mindful that the pursuit of getting ahead can bring disorder to our priorities. This disorder is captured insightfully with what David Brooks called the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. Resume virtues reflect the skills we bring to the marketplace. Eulogy virtues, such as compassion and courage, are what we hope people will say about us at our funeral. We know that eulogy virtues are more important than resume virtues. However, most of us are more skilled in building an external career than in building an internal core of character. Virtue-based leaders are best developed by the company they keep and by the culture in which they operate. When personal and professional relationships are defined by virtue, we feel safe. And when we feel safe, we are prepared to act with courage, to lead change, and to innovate. Ultimately, virtue is internally developed and requires practice. What we can't see leads to success that we can see. As Plutarch pointed out over 2,000 years ago, what we achieve inwardly will change outer reality. 1. Better humans, better performance. We can't always control what happens. We can always control our response. The ideas in this book were influenced by a dinner and a lunch. The dinner was with Anthony Ray Hinton, who was sentenced to the death penalty and was imprisoned for 30 years for a crime he did not commit. The lunch was with Edie Egger, a Holocaust survivor, two stories of unimaginable cruelty that paradoxically inspire hope rather than despair. two stories about becoming better humans and performing better that are relevant for any thoughtful leader, team, or family. Edwin's, the name of the restaurant where Mr. Hinton shared his story, is one of America's most successful social enterprises, and it's a place that illustrates the key ideas in this book. Edwin's, which stands for Education Wins, gives formerly incarcerated adults culinary and hospitality skills while providing the necessary support to transition to civilian life successfully. In 2007, Edwin's was founded as an expensive French restaurant. Since its founding, it has added a bakery, butcher shop, apartments, and basketball courts. During the pandemic, the restaurant pivoted within days to deliver takeout food for shut-in customers rather than close as many restaurants did. Edwin's has achieved remarkable business success and growth by embracing people whom Brian Stephenson calls the poor, the disfavored, the accused, the incarcerated, and the condemned. The mission of Edwin's is based on a simple principle. Everyone deserves a second chance, including those who have served their time. This doesn't mean that Edwin's takes it easy on people. In fact, excellence in culinary skill, hospitality, and teamwork is expected. While people are held accountable for results, they also receive rent-free places to live, legal support, and healthcare to combat the challenges of a criminal record, poverty, and transportation instability. Edwin's embodies the principle that what happens to people outside of work hugely affects how well they perform. So, Edwin's business case is that investing in people to provide stability allows them to perform better in the workplace. Similarly, focusing on family and life issues is not just a nice thing to do. It is critical to achieving performance excellence in life and in the workplace. For most people, any anger or fear they feel at home and in their families will contribute to fractured teams at work and in society. All teams benefit from fewer fractures that are fueled by anger and fear, and they will benefit from more repair mended by goodwill and gratitude. The other business case for Edwin's, of course, is that by preventing recidivism of former convicts, the high costs to society of supporting the imprisoned are avoided. Edwin's isn't a story about perfect people. It is a story about imperfect people becoming better humans and performing better, which is also what you need where you work. Customers win by receiving award-winning French cuisine. Graduates win by acquiring hospitality skills that are in high demand so they can change the trajectory of their lives. Society wins because Edwin's graduates pay taxes rather than costing taxpayers about $40,000 a year to be imprisoned. How successful is Edwin's in living up to its mission of giving people a second chance? About 95% have jobs waiting for them, and only 1% of their graduates return to prison compared to the 46% recidivism rate nationally. The secret sauce isn't the chestnut fennel soup. The key ingredient is helping people become better at who they are, to become better at what they do. This is a theme that reappears throughout this book. Better humans build the resilient muscles needed by all leaders, teams, and families to bounce back from setbacks. Mild setbacks don't do justice to the intentional cruelty experienced by Mr. Hinton and Edie. Thankfully, few of us face that level of injustice, and comparing our plight with their trauma isn't the point. The point is that no leader, team, or family goes through life unscathed. If we can avoid trouble, we should. However, when our backs are against the wall, Mr. Hinton and Edie offer lessons on how to handle painful events with more grace and grit. We start with Mr. Hinton, whose only crime was being black and lacking funds to afford legal representation to prevent prosecutors and police from hiding evidence that would have exonerated him. For 28 years, Mr. Hinton lived in a death row cell the size of a bathroom, which was 33 feet from where 53 men and one woman were electrocuted. After an inmate was electrocuted, the smell lingered in the air for several days. For 3 years, Mr. Hinton refused to speak to guards or prisoners. He was self-absorbed with his innocence, holding tightly to the hope that the truth would finally set him free. One day, after an electrocution, a person who lived on the cell block near Mr. Hinton started to sob uncontrollably. Mr. Hinton hoped he would shut up since he was consumed by grief for not having been with his own sick mother. Overwhelmed, Mr. Hinton started crying. Empathy pulled him out of his grief and pushed him toward the scared prisoner whose name he didn't know. He asked his first question to a prisoner in 3 years. "Hey, you okay?" The question started a conversation. Mr. Hinton shared that his mother was the love of his life and that he had just learned she had died. The man responded that he was sorry. Then other unseen prisoners spoke up. "Sorry for your loss." For a brief moment, strangers replaced cruelty with kindness. Mr. Hinton reflected on what his mother had taught him. Treat everyone with respect, and she meant everyone. So, Mr. Hinton started a remarkable path to forgiveness. "I was on death row, but not by my choice. I had made the choice to spend the last 3 years thinking about killing McGregor, the prosecutor, and thinking about killing myself. Despair was a choice. Hatred was a choice. Anger was a choice. Hope was a choice. Faith was a choice. And more than anything else, love was a choice. Compassion also was a choice." Mr. Hinton became the person to whom prisoners and guards went for advice. He made a family with the people who were in front of him, the innocent and the guilty, the harmless and the dangerous. He even taught a former KKK member how to discuss books with African Americans. Death row inmates learned that the more they got to know individuals' stories, the more they could forgive those individuals, at least a little bit, for what they had done. And they learned that forgiveness offered a new future. In 2014, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously overturned Mr. Hinton's conviction on appeal. This outcome would not have happened without the competent and determined representation of Brian Stevenson, founder of the Equal Justice Initiative. The Supreme Court ruled that Mr. Hinton's original defense lawyer was constitutionally deficient. This led the state of Alabama to drop all charges against Mr. Hinton. As Mr. Hinton walked away after 3 decades of injustice, a guard told him, "You will be back." Mr. Hinton knew the comment was a lie, just like his conviction. He told the guard, "Watch and see." The most incredible part of Mr. Hinton's story is how he transcended cruelty with compassion. What I learned about forgiveness is that it's not about the other person, it's about me. I didn't forgive those people who did this to me because they asked me to or because they called me or wrote me. I didn't forgive them so that they could sleep good at night. I forgave them so I could sleep good at night. Astonishingly, Mr. Hinton isn't bitter despite being treated with cruel injustice. He says, "Bitterness kills the soul. I've seen hate at its worst. How would hate benefit me?" Now for the lunch with Edie. A retired Navy SEAL had read the book, The Choice, and he learned that the author lived in San Diego. He arranged for a small group to have lunch with the author, a Holocaust survivor named Dr. Edith Egger. She asked us to call her Edie. In 1944, Edie and her mother and sister, Magda, were forced into a cattle car destined for the killing camp of Auschwitz, where 1.3 million people were enslaved and 1.1 million were murdered. Facing the three women as they exited the train was a cynical lie that had been posted to reassure the weary. "Arbeit macht frei," work sets you free, hung over the entrance of the camp. Hungry, exhausted, and scared, the mother and daughters were herded into a stockyard to be inspected by the sadistic Nazi physician, Joseph Mengele. He asked Edie whether the eldest of the three women was her mother. Edie said yes. Mengele then wagged his finger toward the gas chamber for the mother. He wagged his finger to the sign, "Work sets you free." For the two sisters, with no mention that beatings, hard labor, and malnutrition came next. The following day, the younger daughter asked a guard where her mother was. The guard pointed to ash pouring out of a chimney, saying, "That's your mother." At our lunch, Edie told us that the Nazis made clear that she was subhuman and a cancer on society. They told her that the only good that could come of her was to leave as a corpse. After telling us this, she punched the air to make clear what she thought of Nazi inhumanity. "Even at Auschwitz, I refused to be a victim. Edie made a distinction between victimhood and victimization. Victimhood occurs when a terrible mistreatment or misfortune happens to us. Victimization occurs when we internalize that event and become a victim. Edie's point was that, while we cannot control our fate, we can always control our response, even in a Nazi death factory. A couple of years after her release, Edie had recovered physically from the wounds inflicted by the concentration camp. However, she said the worst prison was not the one the Nazis put her in. It was the one she built for herself. Her point was that we can be psychologically chained to our past without realizing that the key is in our pocket. Viktor Frankl, who also survived a Nazi death camp and wrote poignantly about the experience, helped liberate her mentally. Frankl wrote Man's Search for Meaning, which chronicled his experiences at the hands of the Nazis, and went on to say that true freedom is achieved in how we respond to our circumstances, since we often cannot control those circumstances. Edie said, Viktor Frankl gave me permission not to hide anymore. He helped me find words for my experience. He helped me to cope with my pain. Edie credited Frankl for helping her find a purpose for her suffering. Edie earned a PhD in psychotherapy so she could liberate others from victimhood. She concluded our lunch by encouraging us to foster strong relationships in which we give and receive support, to live by our highest moral standards, to view adversity as an opportunity to develop wisdom, and to replace victimhood with taking responsibility for our own growth. She taught us how courage, hope, and the other virtues lead to resilience. Hearing Mr. Hinton's and Edie's stories may make all of our troubles seem small by comparison, although Edie would be the first to say that there is no contest when it comes to trauma. When treated with intentional cruelty, we expect people to respond with fear, anger, doubt, and the desire to curl up in on themselves. That makes sense. What is harder to wrap our head around is how Mr. Hinton and Edie became better instead of bitter. Slowly, very slowly, over years, they both became better humans, and then both began to perform better as authors, speakers, and humans. Mr. Hinton and Edie learned to normalize discomfort. Their resilience was strengthened by people who cared about them. Most importantly, their experiences taught them that character is a skill that, like any skill, can be learned. Better humans. The premise of this book, which is borne out by robust evidence from diverse sectors around the globe, is that we get great performance when we are better humans. A metaphor comes to mind here. The seven classical virtues are like the roots of a tree. When a tree has strong roots, as when cultures are grounded in the virtues, the tree and the leader, team, organization, and family are firmly grounded and will thrive, even in the face of gale force winds, drought, or trauma. But the roots of the tree are below the surface. They are hidden while their effect, a healthy tree, is in full view. In a similar vein, the virtues are hidden while their effects on a person's behavior are in full view. Fortunately, evidence-based habits to practice virtue are backed by academic and field research with businesses as well as organizations in sectors like healthcare, academia, professional and college sports, NASA, and the military. This research has shown that leaders defined by high competence and low character cannot deliver sustainable results. They might deliver results when the market is in their favor, but this success won't be lasting, and the reputational risk to the organization isn't worth it. Likewise, leaders with high character and low competence cannot deliver sustainable results. The well-intentioned incompetent can do plenty of damage. However, part of being a person of character is not being satisfied until a reasonable degree of competence is achieved. Despite the evidence that character increases performance, most leadership models focus on competence, ignoring character or limiting its impact to signage on the hallway walls. In contrast, leadership models at organizations like the U.S. Military Service Academies view virtue as the key to developing the competence and commitment necessary to build and lead resilient teams that can succeed under any conditions. To be clear, virtue isn't a self-improvement plan. It is a way to live. Virtue is also aspirational. No individual or culture is completely virtuous, nor is any individual or culture completely devoid of virtue. We all flunk practicing virtue perfectly, making it wise to practice virtue with humility. An unpretentious approach enables us to create a culture where we learn from mistakes rather than gain skill assigning blame. Character-based leaders do want to win, just not at all costs. They protect their organization's reputation and financial strength by bringing value to the people they serve. They learn to view pressure as a privilege, an opportunity to make life better for others. 2,500 years ago, Aristotle defined a first principle as the first basis by which a thing is known. The first principle is to improve the lives of others, which in turn improves our life. Applied to our professional life, when we cultivate virtue in ourselves and others, we not only flourish as a leader, physician, athlete, educator, engineer, or soldier, we also flourish as a human. Applied to organizations and teams, when we cultivate virtue, engagement goes up. Applied to our personal life, when we cultivate virtue, we deepen and strengthen relationships in our family and among our friends. However, the benefits of flourishing, engaging, and caring relationships come with the price of struggle and blunders. The ancient Greeks were clear that excellence is not solely affected by the hand that is dealt, but by how that hand is played. In fact, a life of relative struggle and tension helps us live up to our potential far more than an untested life full of comfort and pleasure. The affluent and the disadvantaged can both miss this essential insight, albeit for different reasons. The affluent might be insulated from adversity, which reduces their ability to excel in uncertain or difficult circumstances. Affluence can create a sense of superiority that can make people feel entitled and be self-absorbed. On the other hand, the disadvantaged face no end of adversity, with little support to help turn obstacles into character-enhancing triumphs. Feeling either entitled if you are affluent or aggrieved if you are disadvantaged can lead to fragility in a world that demands resilience. Since we are all susceptible to feeling entitled or aggrieved, what do we do? When we select a well-worn path to practice virtue, we will know how to respond to prosperity. Of those to whom much has been given, much is expected. When injustice is directed at us or others, we move toward the kind of trouble former Congress member and civil rights leader John Lewis advocated. Ordinary people with extraordinary vision can redeem the soul of America by getting in what I call good trouble, necessary trouble. It's curious to think that we need research to prove that a life governed by trust, compassion, courage, wisdom, and hope would be vastly superior to a life defined by their absence, distrust, callousness, cowardice, foolishness, and despair. That said, if you remain skeptical, data show that virtue significantly increases engagement. For example, at Parker, a Fortune 250 company, leaders completed seminars on the virtues and were then coached for 3 months afterward to integrate those virtues into their operations. At each facility, 9 to 12 months after the seminars, engagement scores increased by 10 to 20%. Additional research on engagement will be presented in Chapter 7. Lastly, these seven virtues cross social, religious, and cultural divides. The research for this book spans multiple continents. Despite obvious cultural differences, North American, European, Middle Eastern, Asian, and African leaders with whom we have worked all know that virtue consistently unites rather than divides people. The challenge is creating a culture where the practice of virtue becomes a norm. Although we know we won't be perfectly virtuous, when we even tilt toward virtue a bit more, engagement increases. But there is a catch. We don't offer quick fixes. Creating a culture of excellence takes time and focused intention. Jackass attached to angel wings. Rumi, a 13th century poet, gives us an image that affirms an insight offered by Mr. Hinton. Nobody lives life perfectly, Rumi said. Each one of us is a jackass, with wings of angels tacked on. Rumi's point is that people are a complex blend of unwise, the jackass, and wise, the angel. He advises us to avoid being an ass and/or to stop being a stubborn mule. When we are governed by our lower mule impulses, we crawl. When we are governed by our higher angelic nature, we soar. Let's be clear that virtue is not about a purity code that no one can actually live up to. Virtue is not about being self-righteous. Few have earned the right to measure others with their moral yardstick. Jigoro Kano.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?